Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We'll be talking technology on the show today. We do that the second Monday of every month. And today we'll be talking about how to set up your Wi-Fi network to make the most of your internet. What do you want to know about webcams or security or online banking? What to know if you're thinking of buying a new computer? Those are some of the things we can tackle with our guest, Jesse LeGru, back with us once again. He's the information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He works with designing, developing, implementing security standards and protocols. So, questions on how to improve your Wi-Fi or set up a webcam, maybe. You have questions about security or buying a new computer, or maybe you're just having a tech problem. Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jesse LeGru, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Thanks. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Well, I tell you what, we've got Wi-Fi, we've got routers, we've got hotspots, and I get enough questions about these to really realize that not everybody knows what all these things mean. So talk about each one, Wi-Fi, routers, and hotspots, what they do for us, how they're different or similar.
Yeah, I think the items we normally hear about on a day-to-day basis are cable modems, routers, and Wi-Fi or access points. And a lot of times these are actually combined into one device. So from your internet provider, you actually might get one device that has all of them combined, which is actually pretty common these days, rather than having individual devices for specific functions. A lot of those functions are kind of built into one device. So it kind of blurs that line that we normally think about. In a large company, you actually might have individual devices that are used for different purposes. In a traditional home network, you actually are probably only using maybe just one, maybe two devices to basically do all those functions for you. And you can often get that from your internet provider. So, you know, you have your router, which generally allows you to connect potentially to a modem, your internet connection. That router allows you to share your internet connection to multiple devices. So instead of having a traditional network, you only have one device you can use on the internet. That router basically allows all of those different devices to share that internet connection using what they call an IP address. So they're using the same IP address and the same internet connection all at the same time. And traditionally, that's cabled, but a router might also have a wireless component built into it, which allows you to, instead of needing to plug into the network all the time, you can be a little bit more mobile. You can be using a cell phone, you can use a laptop, or even a desktop with a wireless adapter. So you don't need to use a cable to plug directly into your router. So the router, it might have an access point built in, which allows you to wirelessly connect. It may have also that modem built in, which might be allowing you to connect from the internet connection to your home. And you can be using that wired or wireless connection to access the internet. Most people are probably doing a variety of things, but wireless is so easy to use these days, and it's easier than being tethered to a cable. Most people are using wireless all the time because who wants to be sticking around the basement where your internet connection probably is? You'd rather be upstairs or somewhere else. Just to get you know, your internet and do what you need to do. It's easy to be feel cooped up these days, so a lot of people do like to be mobile, and they're taking advantage of that wireless access.
Well, lots of people are learning more about how much internet use their internet provider can really handle. Aside from adding onto our internet plans, are there products or things we can do to improve our internet connection and speed?
There are a few things. With COVID-19 and everything going on, there have been a variety of efforts from internet service providers to actually proactively increase speeds. One thing I'd recommend to everyone, especially if you do notice that you are having a slower time connecting to the internet, you know, verify what your speed actually is. There's a variety of testing services on the internet. Many times, if you do use a streaming service, they actually have built-in bandwidth testing because they want to make sure you have, you know, the best connection for 480p content or 4K content. So you can use that data to at least measure what your internet connection is and then compare that to what you are actually supposed to be getting from your internet service provider. It at least gives you a good metric to find out, do you have the full bandwidth available to you? This can be affected by other people in your area using it at the same time, but it can at least help you troubleshoot your connection. Most people, since they are not going to work, if this is new for being at home throughout the day, you actually may not really have a good idea what your internet connection looks like during the day or when significantly more people are using it. So it's always good to get some data behind that and talk to your internet service provider. Now, if that's all fine, there's a lot of things we find that are going on throughout the day we don't really think about. Such as what else is using your internet connection. It could be your TV. It could be a game. You know, kids are at home. They might be playing video games. They might be doing a lot of things. They might be using your internet bandwidth to an extent that you might not be planning for. So, check in to find out if, it is being used by other people in the house. Another good test, unplug devices. Just to save the bandwidth that you have at home to help understand where your bandwidth is coming from. And the great thing about wireless is it allows you to be in a lot of places at the same time. One of the challenges with that is it also allows people to a little bit more effortlessly connect to your wireless connections. So if you don't have it secured with a password or it's not well protected, you might actually have people using your wireless network you wouldn't want to actually be using your wireless network. That can also consume your internet bandwidth and leave you with a slower internet connection. Really, the best thing is, verify you have good speeds, talk to your internet service provider, and verify the devices on your network are the ones you want. If you have something that's not used, that you don't want to use the internet because it's really not a high priority at the time, unplug it, disconnect it, or disable the wireless if you're able to.
You know, my router sits in my basement, and I'm betting that a lot of routers sit in people's basements. Is there a best spot to put that router, by the way?
Ideally, the best place to put that internet connection when you think about connecting in your house would be, it's going to be the best place where you're probably going to use it most of the time. In a house, ideally, it would be directly in the middle of the house, which is, kind of equally available depending on where you are. If you have a living room and a kitchen, maybe that's the most used. That's potentially the best place to have your cable modem, especially if it has one of those wireless access points built in, which a lot of them do. And the wireless is actually going to be the most problematic, because when you do have to go through walls, when there's a larger distance, any kind of interference in between, whether it's natural or unnatural, can impact how good that connection is and how good of an internet service you will get from your wireless device to your router and that internet connection you might have in the basement. So ideally, the closest you can be to it, the better. Based on that, it really is, where do you want to do your work or school most of the time on a day-to-day basis? There are some other things you can do, but ideally it's going to be where you are, especially since we're using wireless probably as our main way to connect.
We have full lines here, Jesse, so I think we'll go to the phones and take some calls now. Gloria in Platteville is up now. Let's go there. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a terrible, terrible time with the Zoom on my computer. All of a sudden, sound went out on my computer, and I've tried various tactics to get that darn sound back on, and I cannot. So when I do a Zoom, people are moving their mouth, but I can't hear them. So if there is a if you know of any way of helping me, I would appreciate it. With the coronavirus, I just don't necessarily want to go someplace. I have a Apple computer. It's a AirBook computer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And get the sound. All right. Well, on it.
So the sound, Gloria can't hear people when she's on Zoom, you know, sort of meeting or whatever. Now, sometimes that's just that they haven't clicked on their microphone, but I'm sure she's probably asked about that. But what do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, the first thing I'd probably do, as long as the normal sound works. So if you go to any kind of video or audio service, if you're listening to podcasts or anything online, if you do get that sound from your computer, at least you know the sound works. You know the speakers work. If that doesn't work as well, and it's not just Zoom, one thing I'd recommend is if you do have headphones available, plug those in, see if those do change. That actually might still be worth trying, even with Zoom plugged in. A lot of different video conference applications, they will pick devices to use in a very different way. And so if you're using Zoom, if you're using Teams, if you're using WebEx, you know, different applications will work very differently, and they might pick different hardware. So I'd recommend even trying a different device to see if it works, or even uninstalling Zoom and reinstalling Zoom in case a setting got changed or configured. There's always application updates that are available, and usually those are automated. But actually uninstalling and reinstalling the very latest version might also help to, one, reconnect all the devices, ensure that you do have the latest software, which might have some fixes in it that could resolve the issue. But using a separate device would be a useful test. In addition, if you do have a cell phone, that could be another possibility, since Zoom and a lot of other video conferencing applications do have mobile applications you can use from iOS or Android devices as well. So it could give you a different method to do it if you still have issues with your Mac. But I would actually try a set of headphones just to see if the Zoom application will see those as a new audio device.
There you go, Gloria. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Gene and Shano, it's your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Thank you for being there.
Sure.
I live off the grid, and I've been using the library and a college up here. I've been using their computers, but as the time goes on, I'm thinking maybe I could buy a laptop. But I'm not. I have no idea how these things connect or anything. So I have a cell phone.
Okay.
And I'd like to keep things simple. So how do I go about connecting to the grid to the internet?
Yeah.
If I get a little laptop.
Okay. Jesse, what do you think?
I guess one question just right off the bat is, do you have an internet connection at home? And if you don't, are you looking to get one?
No, I don't know anything about it because I've been using the library's computers. So.
Okay. There are a couple of different ways to kind of look at the problem. One is the device itself. If you do use the library computers, one thing I'd probably recommend, if you do feel comfortable using those on a day-to-day basis, I would actually consider getting a device that's similar. So, for example, if they are Windows devices, I would recommend getting a Windows machine. If they are Mac devices, you know, something similar, or, for example, Chromebooks. You could probably ask your local library what kind of computers they are using, so at least it would give you a little bit more comfort when using it in a day-to-day basis, and you wouldn't have to learn something all over again. So that would be kind of my first thing when you think about purchasing something. Beyond that, with internet connectivity, there are also a couple different ways you can go with this. One is to actually have an internet connection installed at home, which would require you to talk to different companies, whether it's cable providers or DSL providers or even wireless internet providers, to find out what's available in your areas. I'd actually check with your neighbors as well, because they're likely to be using the services that you're going to be interested in. Or you can simplify things by actually using cellular. So it wouldn't be something installed in your house, but it would be using a similar connection that your cell phone would have. And with that in mind, you might actually be able to get a device from your cell phone provider with a plan, depending on kind of what you're looking for. So if you do want a little bit more simplicity, you could go with a complete cell phone internet plan and potentially even a device through your cell phone provider. The month-to-month charge may be more or less expensive, but that's also another good reason to chat with your neighbors and find out what internet they're using, because it'll at least help you make that decision. And then with a device, I think for day-to-day browsing, there are a lot of great devices out there that are fairly inexpensive. A lot of phones these days are actually more than powerful enough to do what you need to do on a day-to-day basis. It's really just having a keyboard and a screen where you can easily see and interact with it. Chromebooks are great mobile devices. With that and a cellular internet connection, you can actually be using the internet from a web browser and doing a variety of things pretty much anywhere you are. So that's a really great option. But I would actually, you know, check with your check with the library, find out what kind of devices they have, because I think that will help you make that a similar decision, whether it's Windows, Mac OS, or potentially even a Google OS. Or check with your neighbors about their internet connection and kind of what's available, because that will kind of at least give you an idea potentially of some rough costs or who to contact. If you've never had an internet connection at home, it can be a little bit overwhelming, so it's good to get that input from people around you so you at least know the right people to talk to, because you do have a variety of options. And cellular is always an option if you already have a cell plan. Chat with your provider and tell them kind of what you're looking for based on what you had access to at the library, and they might be able to point you in the right direction, and at least it's another data point to find out, is the price right for you? And then you can go and get a little bit more information from other vendors as well.
Gene, thank you so much, and good luck. Appreciate your call very much. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Natalie Guyette, our producer today. Jane Rotunda, our on-air producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your computer and software and webcams. We got all kinds of things to talk about today with Jesse LeGrew from Madison College. And we have callers online. Let's go back to the phones to Scott in Wausau next. Hi, Scott. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Jesse. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about I'm making a slideshow in PowerPoint, and I want to make an old-fashioned DVD that'll play in an old-fashioned DVD player. But every time I try my format, whatever format I try, it doesn't play in the DVD player, but it plays really awesome in the Blu-ray players. But I would like to make it in the DVD format.
So how do we do that, Jesse?
That's a really, really good question. Do you know what program you use to create the DVD that's actually working well on the Blu-ray player?
I have several formats, WMV, MP4, AVI, VOB, MPEG2. All those kind of worked in the Blu-ray, but they don't want to work in the old-time DVD players. And they used to have a program in Windows 7. It's called Windows Movie Maker or something like that. That people used to use, and it worked really good for that type of thing, but they no longer have that in Windows 10, so.
There are actually a few different applications that can do that conversion. I haven't done it recently. I know that there are some you can purchase, and there are some that are free. Using one of the paid versions actually might be the easiest way. They're usually between $20 to $40. I can't recall the applications that are there by that I've at least used in the past for that. There is a DVD video soft free video to DVD converter. which I've used in the past, which has worked pretty well. I think DVD shrink was something that was available in addition. There are some free DVD converters, and basically what they would do is as soon as you have that video file that you've exported, it basically takes that video file and converts it into a format so you can burn a DVD, or you can even burn a CD. Depending on the DVD player, it'll actually read videos from CDs as well. It'll usually create something called an ISO file, .ISO, something that you can burn from the built-in application you have in Windows. You could use other free programs that are out there. I haven't used a lot of them in the past, or at least not recently. Windows Movie Maker was a very easy one to use, and that was freely available. I would check the Windows 10 Marketplace to take a look, but the DVD video soft seemed like a pretty straightforward one to use. I haven't used it myself, but otherwise DVD shrink was a good option. But really anything that can take that video to convert it should work. Usually you want it in a pretty standard format so that you can view it. So it will do those conversions for you, but I would definitely try the DVD shrink, image burn, IMG burn was another popular one. Those are at least the initial recommendations. There are some free options. There are some paid options. I would probably look into actually just paying for an inexpensive option to allow you to convert it to a DVD format, and it should take those raw files for you and put it into a format so you can put it into your DVD player.
There you go, Scott. Thank you so much for calling. Eleanor in Greenwood, it's your turn now. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello, Larry, and hello, Jesse. My computer wants to just plain shut down and usually get an error message called WHEA uncontrollable error. No one seems to know what that means.
Or uncorrectable error, isn't it?
Uncorrectable, yes.
So WHEA, uncorrectable error. What the heck does that mean, Jesse? Do you know?
Well, in this case, it is a Windows error. And in terms of what WHEA is, I actually can't recall off the top of my head. I'm guessing this is a Windows 10 computer.
Eleanor, is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what it actually stands for is Windows Hardware Error Architecture. So that's the WHEA. Generally, it could be indicative of a hardware error or some other problem. It actually also could be a driver error or a general Windows error. There are a few things that they kind of recommend to try to resolve the issue. One, you can actually use the built-in installation disk, which a lot of people probably don't have these days, and you can actually try a self-repair of Windows 10. What I'd probably try to do if you can get into Windows, which doesn't sound like you can, which is kind of an issue, you might actually want to try to go to a recovery partition. Normally when Windows will boot up, depending on where you got your computer from, you might have an option to, right before the Windows logo appears, you can hit the F8 key, or you might have a prompt to go into a recovery mode. Hopefully it'll go into a recovery mode where you can try to automatically repair the PC. Usually that's one of the options. If you can't get to that, one of the things I'd recommend is I'd probably actually tell you to go directly to or call the manufacturer. Usually they have instructions on how to get to that menu so you can attempt the repair. If it is a hardware issue, in the end you're going to have to get the hardware repaired or something replaced. It's hard to know what it is until you're actually able to get into the operating system. Do you know if recently there was an update that was installed or any change to the computer?
This has been going on for a couple years, and we just let it go down and up again because we're retired.
Okay. And it could be, if you're able to use a computer a little bit, it could be a little bit, it could just be a little bit more of an annoyance. I would recommend updating, just going to Windows Update and updating your drivers in addition to any of the Windows software to see if it does correct the issue. if you're actually able to go within Windows, they usually do have a repair option where it can try to repair system files for the computer. If you do have, if you know the manufacturer usually has software installed where it will actually try to do that repair for you. But I would try those repairs. If it is something that does have built-in diagnostics on the computer, I'd recommend running them. It could be a software error. It could be a hardware error. The thing I like to do right away is just to update all your software. That might resolve the issue if there's something out of date that's causing the problem. If none of that works and you can't resolve with fixing Windows from the repair disk or from a repair partition, I would consider reinstalling Windows if you can. I would back up all your data first, whether it's to a cloud service, whether it's to an external hard drive, whether it's to a flash drive. And if you actually do have that recovery partition where you can reinstall Windows, you can do that. Anyone who's worked on a variety of PCs, hopefully you know somebody who at least has installed Windows before, they might be able to walk through that process and help you back up your data. In the end, it still could be a hardware problem. So it's hard to know until you, at least take out those other factors. You might back up everything, reinstall Windows, and then find out you still get the error even after all the updates. It might still be a hardware error that you have to get fixed. If you do want to find out what the problem is, I'd still recommend doing those Windows repairs or reinstalling. Otherwise, if you do need to fix that hardware, the only other recourse you would really have is to take it into a location that would be able to diagnose and potentially replace the hardware.
Wow. There you go, Eleanor. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mike emailed in about his MacBook. He says when he tries to live stream a TV broadcast, for example, from the PBS Wisconsin website, he gets a black screen with the following message: embed disabled on this page. And he's wondering, is this a problem with the MacBook, the website, the internet? So embed has been disabled on the page.
And that is that M-B-E-D?
E-M-B-E-D, I think, or...
Okay. There could be a few different things. It could be, because in this case, it could be video embedding, depending on how the web page is actually being displayed. One thing I'd recommend if you do have an issue with it, just like anything, update all your software. There are a variety of plugins that web browsers will use to view audio content or video content. Making sure those browser plugins and the browsers themselves are up to date is a great thing to do. In addition, if you're using Safari, for example, and you're getting the error, go ahead and download, if you don't already have it, Chrome or a different browser, maybe Opera, just to see if you get a different behavior. Different browsers will work differently, and some of the ones natively available within either Windows or Mac OS may have different capabilities or may automatically disable certain things, primarily for security. In your case, it's hard to know whether it's disabled due to a security feature or disabled because maybe it just doesn't function. But you could also try a different web browser to see if that would resolve the issue. It's an easy enough thing to do. It's free. It takes a few minutes. Otherwise, just I would also update Mac OS, which will update the applications at least built in onto your Mac. That would help with the video playback. So update the software, try a different browser, see if it works. If that doesn't work, that could be a different issue with the website itself. My guess is they probably also have other people commenting on the website of that kind of issue. But the other browser is probably going to be the easiest thing for you to do right away. So try Chrome or try Opera.
There you go, Mike. Thank you so much. Back to the phones. Walter in West Bend, your turn now. Hi, Walter.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I've got a question about Chrome, because I will be doing work. I might have maybe 5 tabs open, sometimes 10 tabs open. and just out of the blue, Chrome shuts down.
Why would that be the case?
There could be a few options. One of the items that Chrome will do every now and again is it'll restart for updates on a regular schedule. The only other item, if it wasn't normal updates, because usually you will get a prompt, click here to restart for updates. It could actually be that there is something on one of the tabs that's open that basically broke Chrome, that caused Chrome to close and then restart. So it could actually be an issue with one of the websites, potentially, that they are actually browsing, that's causing it to shut down and restart. And that is an option actually in Chrome. It's really meant to protect the browser and to protect your computer so that if there is anything on the page that it could be malicious, it doesn't want it to break your computer or do anything else. It wants to make sure that your computer is safe, so it actually might be shutting down that tab. And there is something you might be able to do to help resolve that so it doesn't shut down. If it is that feature, however, it really is there to protect you. I would actually recommend, if you do have the same browser tabs open most of the time, you actually might want to try just opening in a brand new window. And it's possible then that only those specific windows will crash, and you might be able to narrow down what website's doing it. And then you might just want to use a separate browser just for that website. But in the end, it might actually be a protective mechanism. So it's trying to keep you and your computer safe by shutting Chrome down because a website's doing something it really, really shouldn't be doing, or it just caused an error with Chrome. So you can remove, it's called proactive freeze. Otherwise, it could be an update feature. Usually it will prompt you, but it's most likely related to a website that you actually have loaded on your computer. Like most of us, I usually have the same tabs open with the same websites. It's probably one of those doing something it shouldn't be doing, and it's causing Chrome to crash.
There you go, Walter. Thank you so much for calling. Gray in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much. So recently, I've had a weird problem with my Samsung Chromebook. Whenever I plug in headphones to use the audio, I get this weird static sound, and it only happens when I'm using the headphones, not if I just use the normal speakers. And I don't know how to get it to stop, and it's driving me insane.
That could just be a problem at the plug-in of the headphones, couldn't it, Jesse?
That could be. And the sound you're experiencing, it's basically anything that you're listening to on the headphones, you get kind of that extra sound you don't want, correct?
Yeah, I just get that really just low static sound.
Okay. Have you tried the headphones in any other devices yet?
I have a couple pairs. I haven't tried them in any other device, but I don't think it's an issue with the headphones. I've tried a couple different pairs on the Chromebook, and it's the same problem.
Okay. In this case, because one thing I was going to recommend is, try a different device with those headphones to see if it was the headphones themselves, but it sounds like you've actually kind of come to the point where you use different headphones and you kind of get the same behavior. So it really does seem like it is an issue potentially with the plug you have in the Chromebook. One other item that you might want to take a look at, and I haven't looked at least the Chromebook settings for this in the past, they might actually have different volume settings that could be changing how you experience the sound over the headphones, whether it's maybe either too low or it's too high, and you're getting some extra noise from that. One thing you could try is even just kind of wiping out. You'd kind of need a very small cloth, but just to make sure that there's nothing in the headphone jack that could be causing any kind of interference where you're not getting a good connection. If you do that, I'd still recommend if you're putting anything inside a different device, turn off your device I wouldn't recommend, you know, shoving a screwdriver or anything in there, but at least cleaning the connection just to see if there's any issue there, because it does sound like your headphones work and other devices fine. But I would try cleaning it out. Take a look at the sound options for the Chromebook itself and see if that does help. But it does seem like it's an artifact specifically with the Chromebook itself. And I'm guessing you've tried, it does it for different applications. It doesn't matter what you're listening to or where it's coming from.
Yeah, if it's Spotify, Netflix, YouTube, whatever it is, the minute that I hit play, there's that static, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because you can kind of experience normally two things. One, you plug it in, and even without hitting play, you get some noise. Or it waits until you actually hit play on something, so it's active in terms of that kind of feedback you're getting. And it kind of, it almost does feel like it could be a computer setting because it is taking that active sound connection from active playback and applications. So I would just check your volume settings. Usually for most devices, you actually will have different volume settings based on the device you're using, and the computer will remember that. So once you do have it plugged in, take a look at your volume settings and see if you can tweak it a little bit. It might be able to drown out some of that noise if it is different from the built-in speaker. The only other thing I could recommend is if you know somebody who has a different Chromebook, see if they have experienced the same issue. But I'm kind of inclined to think it's either a software setting on your device or it could be the plug itself.
Yep. One or the other, probably. Gray, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen. I appreciate your expertise in this area. I had a Windows Vista system which got too outdated, so I had to purchase an HP Pavilion Windows 10 system, and it's quite a change. I was wondering, A, what is the best browser to use, and also, how do I make sure that all the updates that need to get installed properly?
Okay, Bill, thank you very much for calling. Jesse, what's your advice?
Yeah, for the built-in browsers, you might have two browsers installed, which would be Windows or Internet Explorer or Windows Edge. I would recommend using Edge. Edge is the new browser. Outside of the ones built into Windows, there are a variety of other browsers you can use that are very well supported and used. Chrome, Firefox are two extremely common ones. I actually use different browsers for different needs, just to kind of separate what I'm browsing. And I actually use Internet Explorer, Edge, Chrome, and Firefox. They all work pretty well. Internet Explorer, I'd actually recommend just minimizing use, or if not eliminating it, just because Microsoft is going to be really going towards Edge. It's the browser that they want you to use. It's the one that's going to be updated. It has all the built-in technologies, and it will ensure to get more security updates. So if you had to pick a Microsoft one, pick Edge. Otherwise, use Chrome and Firefox. They're both free, and they're very, very easy to use. If you do want to make sure that your computer is up to date, you can actually just hit the Windows key and type in update. One of the options you should see is check for updates or Windows update settings. From there, you'll actually be able to just check for updates automatically, but you can also change the setting to ensure that it says install my updates automatically, which will have another option of whether it automatically restarts your computer. I always recommend turning that automatic update feature on. Otherwise, if not, you know, have something in your calendar maybe every couple of weeks to click on that button to check it, to install any updates, and then restart your computer. So just search for Windows Update after you hit the Windows key or Control Escape, and you'll automatically get to those automated settings. That will also install any updates for Internet Explorer and Edge because it is built into Windows. If you did want to install updates for Chrome or Firefox, usually the browsers at this point already have that check for update service built in, so you don't have to do anything yourself. But you can always check. They do have a help menu item, and then you can check the version and check for updates there as well. But Chrome, Firefox, or Edge would be my recommendations. Edge comes automatic. The other two are completely free to download.
There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Jesse LeGrue, Information Security Architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at improving Wi-Fi, your webcam, security, online banking, finances, buying a new computer or laptop, all kinds of things with our guest, Jesse LeGrue from Madison College, their technology services group. Questions? The lines are filled. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And John in Waukesha has the next question, so let's go to John. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Quick question. I have six security cameras on my system, and I disconnected the modem to clean underneath it and put it back in the same place, and now I can't get the cameras to work.
So six cameras. Shut the modem off, turned it back on right in the same place, and now the cameras won't work.
None of them. And I reinstalled the passwords and reset the modem. I can't get it to work, the cameras.
Not connecting somehow there, Jesse.
Are the cameras you have, do they connect to your network wirelessly?
Yes.
One thing I'd probably recommend for the wireless cameras is to probably turn them off and turn them back on just to reacquire the signal for your wireless. Do you, on your wireless access point or router, do you have a screen where you can see what devices are connected?
No.
Okay. For any kind of wireless device, whether it's a camera or anything else, whenever you disconnect the router or the access point, many devices will automatically reconnect pretty seamlessly, depending on other devices, cameras, for example, since there's a variety of options out there, they might need a little bit more help, and that help might actually be unplugging the device, basically power cycling it, and then powering the device back up so it can reconnect to your wireless network. So it sounds like you've already kind of done the power cycle for your router or your wireless access point. I'd recommend doing the same thing probably to each one of your cameras to let them power back on and then hopefully reconnect to your wireless network. Then after that, see if they do appear. Depending on the wireless camera, it probably did come with they usually call it like a discovery application or a setup application where it will scan your wireless network to look for those devices. Usually it's only the first time you set it up because after you set it up, you really don't touch it anymore. But it might be able to help redetect those devices because the IP address may have changed. Usually the username and password will stay the same. But if it does reconnect, it may get a different IP address, which means all the little links and all the places it's expecting to find those cameras have changed. So I'd recommend rerunning that application, see if it can find it. The worst case would be to potentially take one of the cameras and reset it to factory defaults so you can reconfigure it to connect to your wireless network and basically set the whole thing up from scratch. Ideally, you wouldn't have to do that. That would be kind of a last-ditch effort in the event that power cycling the cameras didn't work and you didn't have an easy application to kind of scan your home network to look for those cameras and the new IP addresses. Because my guess is even if it is attaching to your wireless network now, it's possible the IP addresses have changed, and that's why the camera system's not able to find them. So you have to find out what those new IP addresses are so that the system can basically pull that video data to capture pictures or to capture that video stream.
There you go. Good luck with that, John. Appreciate it. Reggie in Oshkosh, moving on to you now. Hi, Reggie. What's on your mind?
Hi. So I just had a little suggestion for some people with wondering what browser to use. I use Windows 10, and I use a third-party browser called Vivaldi. And I don't know what experience you've had with that, Jesse, but I find it very easy to use. It outpowers Chrome and especially Firefox on everything I've had to use. I can have multiple browsers open. It's very user-friendly and very customizable if you're really into what you're doing. Security is great. It has a password manager so that you can save passwords but then go in and edit them yourself or automatically update them when you update them on a website. So for maybe some people who aren't very user-friendly, it's great, always updating. And I was just throwing that out there for people who might be looking for a better browser or something more user-friendly.
Vivaldi. Have you used it, Jesse?
I haven't used it myself. I've heard a lot about it, and a lot of people do like it. It's a great suggestion for people.
All right, there we go. Just go online and look it up and take a look. Pam in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hi. My son just got a refurbished Chromebook, and a little notice comes up on the screen saying Windows 7 is no longer supported. I just recently had Windows 10 installed on my computer, and I think that they said that I could have it installed on 5 other devices. So my question is, would this be a good thing to do? And would I do it through Microsoft? Is that the best way to have that installed?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Windows 7, as of earlier this year, I believe it was in January, is no longer supported, which means no critical updates are available for it. So if there is a security vulnerability, if there's even a fix to an application or a feature release, Windows 7 will not get those updates. So I highly recommend anyone who does have Windows 7 or any outdated operating system update to not necessarily the latest if you don't have to. In this case, Windows 10 is probably the way you're going to have to go. So I would recommend updating to Windows 10. If you do have availability of installing the operating system on more than one device, you know, up to 5 devices, and that's covered by your license, I would recommend actually going that direction and downloading the Windows 10 update and installing it on that device. Windows, you know, 7 is out of date, so I would, at the very least, just recommend you have an updated operating system so you can get updates. And most likely no one's going to be installing Windows 8 or 8.1. So Windows 10 is kind of the only option you have. So go ahead and update. I would use the license you currently already have as long as it kind of abides by the licensing agreement. And go ahead and update. Before you do that, I would also recommend on that device, back up all the data just to make sure that if there is some kind of issue with the upgrade, you do have the files backed up. In the end, you can always install Windows 10 afterward if you do need to kind of restore from scratch. But I always recommend if you do a large operating system update for whatever system you're doing, back up the data first to ensure that you can go back if you really need to.
And thanks very much, Pam, for calling. Jeff wonders about some news that he's heard that essentially exposure to wireless is indisputably hazardous to health. Wonders if this is true, and if it is, what's a safe distance?
And generally, I think there's been a variety of information kind of floating around about this for a variety of wireless technologies. And generally, the wireless technologies have been deemed safe. Anything that does have kind of a higher power consumption, there's always, a potential worry of how that could affect somebody for the wireless that we use on a day-to-day basis throughout where we kind of live and work. Those are relatively safe. And I mean, granted, I'm not a doctor, but the technologies have been safe, and we've been using them for quite some time. And if they were, they did pose a significant health risk, we would stop using them.
Susan in Eagle River emailed, the satellite internet is the only option in the Eagle River area, at least in her area. She says it's relatively slow, data is limited. She's tried Google Hangouts and Zoom, but it's jerky, goes blank at times. Any advice, or should she stick with old-fashioned emails and phone calls?
There are a few different options with this. Satellite can be challenging, especially if you do live in an area where you have limited internet. There are a few different items you could try. One would be to augment your service using a cellular connection from your phone. And you can actually use your phone for video and your other satellite connection for audio. Or you can downscale your video so it doesn't take as much bandwidth. Being able to do that should allow for some better transfer back and forth and give you a better overall, at least experience, even though you may not be able to get that full video quality.
Our guest today, Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He'll be with us till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jesse. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest today, Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect. He's in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Talking with him about a lot of things on the show today, from how to make your home Wi-Fi as strong as possible to how to make sure you're being safe when online banking, using things like PayPal or Venmo. So, questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, Jesse, we have Joe in Stevens Point with a question for you. Let's go there. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jesse. I'm trying to update my older iPhone. Yeah, it's 2 years old, and my storage is full, and I'm not allowed to load stuff up to the cloud. And I have a lot of pictures and videos on there. I'm wondering how am I going to go about doing that?
Okay, the phone's full.
And this is an iPhone, correct?
Yep.
Yes.
Exactly. Five or six. I believe it's six.
Okay. If you're not able to upload it to the cloud, one thing I would recommend, and you've probably already done this, but I'd recommend actually pairing it with a laptop or a desktop with the iTunes application and syncing it there. The photos and a lot of that native data will actually synchronize between the computer and the phone. So it should at least be able to download a lot of video, audio, or picture content, which generally, I think for probably most of us, is usually a lot of the storage that it takes up, which means that you can then at least copy it from your desktop and then remove it from the iPhone. Have you tried that yet?
I do not have a desktop or a laptop. I do have an iPad.
Okay. And that kind of a little bit limited there than in terms of being able to download that data. If you can't upload it to iCloud, you might be able to find a third-party application to actually upload that content to from the App Store. I haven't used any of them, at least myself, but if you do have different accounts, either through Microsoft or Dropbox, you actually might be able to install one of those applications as well. Dropbox, for example, is free for, I believe it's 2 gigabytes of storage space. That will install on an Android device. It will also install on an iPhone or an iPad. And you can actually synchronize your pictures or other data to that service, and you can actually pay for an increased storage as well. So if you do have an active internet connection and you're able to download an application, that would be a viable option, and you could do it basically even with the free account until you are able to download all that local content. In the end, you're going to have to find a way to put it somewhere if you don't have a laptop or a desktop, so you can clear up that storage space. Is the iCloud option just not working for you or otherwise not available?
I have a feeling it's because I haven't got the update.
Okay. If that's the case, you still might actually have an – you could potentially also have an issue where – in order to actually install Dropbox, you might run into the same issue if you are that full on storage space. Normally what I'd recommend, which is going to be probably a little bit more challenging to do today, I would recommend to find somebody with a laptop or a desktop or go to an Apple store so they can download it on their device so then you can at least delete a picture or two and free up some space and then install the application. One thing you might be able to do that could go around it, even though it's going to be a little bit more time intensive, is you can email yourself a few pictures at a time until you're able to free up just enough storage space to install Dropbox or another application that will allow you to get even more data off of your device, ensure that it's stored somewhere else, and then go ahead and install the update. The biggest item with even installing it, installing Dropbox and syncing your content, if you're not careful, the way it synchronizes data, usually if you add a photo or another document, it'll add it to that cloud service like Dropbox, but it'll also work the other way around, where if you delete it, it will also delete it from that cloud service. So you'd want to make sure that once you do have it in that cloud service, that you can take a copy of that and store it somewhere else. So I'd find some ways to just free up a little bit of the storage space, maybe by emailing yourself a few pictures. Delete those pictures once you know it's in your email. Hopefully that will free up enough space to install something like Dropbox so you can synchronize some of that content, back it up, again, to make sure that once you clear out that data, it doesn't delete it from Dropbox, then do the update, and then hopefully you'll be in a better place from there. In the end, it kind of sounds like you might need some additional storage, but hopefully Dropbox will allow you to at least use it a little bit more seamlessly in the future to give you that needed storage, and you know it's backed up somewhere else when you need it.
And Joe, if you're like me and have four or five pictures of the same thing, I went through all my photos when I had that issue and I was able to eliminate a lot of photos where I had Emily, for example, daughter Emily, like four pictures in a row of her running in a cross country event. I kept one and got rid of the other three. And went through my whole picture file that way and was actually able to open up quite a bit of space. So there you go, Joe. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Tom and Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Quick question. We have a hotspot that gives us our internet and allows us to stream movies. It works fine on Netflix, but it does not work fine for some other the streaming services. My question is, do we need a router to improve whatever it is that's preventing us from streaming those other streaming services?
Acorn or BritBox, yeah.
I would say overall, my quick answer would be no. If you do have basically the bottleneck you're going to have in terms of whether you're going to get that service or at least get good quality is really the hotspot itself and what kind of connectivity it has. Having a router just allows you to share that connectivity a little bit more effectively between different devices. If it does work, you know, better for Netflix than others, it could be the video quality. Maybe the video quality for the other services is a little bit higher and that's causing the issue. The other possibility could be how many devices are using the hotspot at the same time. In the end, getting a router is not going to improve performance. It's sharing really that same bottleneck, which is your hotspot, amongst different devices, and it's not going to really increase your connectivity. The only thing I could recommend would be to, lessen the amount of devices using the hotspot at the same time, or even for the video services that you might be having more problems with, they usually do have some options you can change for caching options, you know, how much of the content will it download before starting to stream that content, in addition to the video quality settings. So you might be able to turn down the quality settings a little bit to get a more seamless streaming experience, or you might be able to download a little bit more of the data up front so you don't have as many kind of stops and starts with that video content. But in this case, I don't think a router is going to help you. Really, the hotspot itself has that functionality built in.
All right, Tom, thank you for calling. Brett in Boston, your turn. Hi, Brett.
Hey, I'm a rural Wisconsin resident, and my broadband access options are quite limited. We recently, within the last year, went with my cell phone company providing a Wi-Fi router for the home. With all we've got going on with the coronavirus, I just wondered if them opening up where we have actual unlimited data, although we pay for unlimited, it ends up throttling down before the end of the month. I just wonder if, is that adding significant cost, or is that something that maybe after the coronavirus is a thing of the past, that they're going to be able to keep that actual unlimited data?
It's a really, really good question. My guess is that at some point, once the demand and the kind of situation changes over time, that kind of unlimited connectivity from our cellular connections, because a variety of companies are doing it, just so people can work or learn from home. My guess is that's going to go away because they have basically charged a premium to basically, you know, generate revenue for people who use more data. I'd like it to stay around for, you know, forever. I kind of get this impression. That's been a very good way to, at least for the companies, to generate revenue, is to charge a premium for those services. In this case, we're in a very unique situation, so everyone's really in need of that. I think once the situation changes, I have a feeling it's going to go back to what it was before. But, I mean, time will tell. I just don't think it's going to be unlimited for the future. But I think it is one of those items that is a part of the conversation of should this be kind of a common good service that is really available to everyone, which also brings up the conversations of having, broadband internet and this kind of connectivity more as a general utility that's available to all for more standard pricing. Time will tell on that. I have a feeling it's going to change back to what it was, but we'll see when the time comes.
There you go, Brett. Thank you for calling with that good question. Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hello. I have an outbuilding which is made of metal and has a metal roof, and it's about 300 feet from the house, and I'd like to get internet out to it. Problem is that metal building, I don't even get a cell signal inside the building, and I was wondering if there's some way, there's some equipment that would allow like a wireless link between that the two buildings where I could take the signal inside, maybe even via wire, inside the metal building then. Have a switch or router inside?
Yeah, it's a good question. So basically, your shed is acting like a Faraday cage. It's blocking all signals coming in and going out. So in order to extend wireless, and I think this is also a challenge with people just in a house where you might have more area and the wireless signal doesn't penetrate certain walls. Basically, what you need to do is extend your wireless network. If you're in a house, you'd use something like a mesh wireless system that can allow you to basically install more access points to saturate more of your home with that wireless signal, and it gets repeated from, where you're plugged into the internet all throughout different parts of the house. What you actually really need to do is kind of do the same thing, but you would actually install an access point or a repeater. Basically, one would be at your main building in your house, and one would be at this outbuilding that's all in metal. You would have to have the antenna outside of that metal, you know, building so it can receive the signal that you have at home, and basically it would allow you to repeat that internet or that network connectivity you have from your home to the access point that you have in that metal building. And then inside that metal building, you could have an internal antenna that you're connecting to. You could also have a cable that you could plug into for a device, and it would be using that wireless connection between those two locations. So what you're looking for a wireless repeating system. You might also find mesh wireless systems. But one interesting project, and this could be a great weekend project, is looking for, and you can just Google this, Pringles can wireless systems. Pringles cans generally are metal on the inside, and they can actually help to create a good directional antenna. So you can actually broadcast the wireless from your house and beam it basically directly to a point, or at least to an area on that outbuilding, so you can receive it and then feed that inside of the building. I've had a variety of people do that. You can actually do it over multiple miles, potentially, if you have line of sight. So the biggest thing is picking an area where you can see the shed and where that antenna receiving the signal is going to be from where you're sending it. You want that line of sight. You don't want anything in between it. But, you know, go ahead and Google Pringles antenna. You'll find all sorts of great stuff. But it's just a wireless repeater. You just need something to be able to receive that on your outbuilding. So you're going to have to drill, you know, you're going to have to drill a hole somewhere just to make sure you can get that signal and feed it back inside. But at least it should get you started for a good weekend project.
There you go. Oh, I hadn't heard of that. Pringles. All right. Thanks, Rick, again. CT in West Allis, your turn. Hi, CT.
Hey, Larry. You had a caller who was talking about his iPhone being full of pictures and videos, and he was looking for some alternatives to be able to download those and clear up space in the phone. Another alternative is a device sold by SanDisk. It's called an iXpand, little letter A, capital X-P-A-N-D. It's a flash drive that works specifically with iPhones with an app, and you're able to plug it into the phone, copy the pictures and video off the phone onto the iXpand, and then it has a USB connection. So you can plug it into a computer, and it works slick. And you can copy stuff from your phone to the iXpand, or from the iXpand to your phone. And whatever you have stored on there, if you plug it back into the phone, you can look at the pictures, you can play the video. I even got it to play MP3 music, which iPhones really don't like. And it's a great little alternative. They retail, I think it's like about $35 for a 32 gigabyte and $45 for a 64 gigabyte. You know, wow. And it's a simple alternative, and it's not involving another computer or a cloud service. It's to the phone from the phone.
Well, I like that idea. Thanks for calling. Jesse, are you familiar with the iXpand?
No, I haven't seen it before, but that's a really, really great option. And, you know, they're freely available and actually, I mean, pretty inexpensive. So if you're looking for either long-term or short-term storage or just to expand that storage for your for a different device, it's a great cost-effective option. I think that's one of the challenges with iPhones or iPads is you really can't expand that storage without buying a new one. This actually gives you a way to do that probably not permanently, because eventually you're going to have to plug in your device to recharge it. But it is a great option if you're just looking to back up that data or find other ways to look at other content. So great option, and it's available in a variety of stores. I hadn't seen it before today. That's great.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. I expand. Well, Patty in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. After 4 months of living on just unlimited cellular data with a phone and an iPad, now I'm back into my house that's been completely renovated. The electrician put in some nice places for me to plug in my smart TV, although that smart TV has always worked flawlessly on my internet before. Now I have, you know, super high-speed internet. What is the benefit of plugging in my smart TV into the wall, having a direct connection as opposed to wireless?
There are, depending on your internet speed, you actually might honestly notice no difference whatsoever. One of the benefits to having it plugged in is if you do have it, if you are using wireless, for example, you do get around a lot of other potential issues such as interference between walls or other cables. So you can get around a lot of that interference by being directly cabled into it. So it can be a benefit there. For most people, depending on the internet connection that they have or the wireless router or access points that they have at home, you may actually really notice no benefit because you don't have the signal challenges or the internet bandwidth challenges where being directly cabled in would actually be a benefit. So every connection, every house is going to be slightly different. In your case, it may not be a benefit until you find out you have more interference because you do have something physically in between where your wireless access point is and your smart TV is. That direct connection can be usually much quicker, lower latency, a little bit zippier, but you might not notice a difference on a day-to-day if you don't have the same challenges. So it always depends from house to house. The one thing with wireless, anything over wireless can transmit secured or unsecured. Being directly cabled in does add a little bit of security because somebody driving around the neighborhood can't at least attempt to capture that information. So it does give you a little bit of safety there. But from a usability perspective, you may not notice any difference whatsoever. Somebody else in a different situation may notice a huge benefit.
So there you go, Patty. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Jesse, it's always a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we certainly will look forward to your next visit. Thank you again. Appreciate
thank
it very much.
Me.
Yeah, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He helps with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. He'll be back in a couple of months in June 8th. Beth Wendt comes back from the Division of Information Technology to talk more technology with you. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about female athletes breaking stereotypes and barriers in the 1920s. And we hear from Olympic gold medalist Jessie Diggins on her journey to making international sports history as a cross-country ski racer. Would you like to hear more about our guests or show topics? Check out our new blog. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. And thank you so much for listening, and I hope you please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.